Good afternoon. So last time we actually met for this lecture, we were talking about kind of the basic operation of caches. We talked about, well, locality was this idea that would make our caches work, that we could predict when accesses would happen in the future from the previous accesses. We had this temporal locality idea which said, well, we're going to repeat previous accesses, most likely. We have the spatial locality idea, which says we're going to access nearby things, most likely. And our cache design allowed us to take advantage of this to achieve an acceptable miss rate. And the design we started with was this direct map cache design. We divided up our addresses into tag index and offset. And we used the index to choose a single block that the value could be stored in. We tracked whether the correct value was stored with a valid bit to say whether there was a value, and a tag to say where in memory did it come from, the tag being the upper bits of the address that we don't use in the lookup. And the offset bits tell us where in the block, you know, does a particular byte come from, because often we'll end up having like 64 byte blocks that we'll store together in our cache. And, well, if we're loading one byte into a carrier, well, there's only one byte we're accessing. And we had this idea that we have in direct map caches, we often have what we call conflict misses, that are, we try to access, you know, some value that we have accessed previously, so it's something we could have had in our cache, but the direct map cache design doesn't allow us to keep two different values for the same set at the same time. So we end up not having it in our cache, so it's a miss, even though it was accessed in the past and was in our cache in the past, but it's been since replaced by something else. And we'll talk about, as our main topic for today, extending beyond that for talking about set-associative caches, which are going to be our kind of primary way of dealing with having fewer conflict misses. We're not going to get rid of them entirely, but we're going to make them less likely without substantially changing our direct map cache design. So before we move on to that, so questions about things we covered way back a week ago, or a week and a half ago. Okay, so I should talk about some logistics before we move on. The cache lab, as is mentioned in the announcement, is due after the break now. And our lectures are out of sync. My plan is that this morning I went over a whole bunch of exercises we won't go over in this lecture in the 9 a.m. lecture. I will figure out exactly where that starts and point you to the appropriate lecture recording if you do that. I think those are mostly kind of review of these caching concepts that may be helpful for the homework. But we'll try to get back in sync. And, you know, as a faculty member, my lecture time is precious. I don't want to lose it. So trying to do something useful. Most of you have, maybe not most, but a lot of you have noticed the midterm is graded. Please note we have some people taking the midterm various sorts of late. We'll probably change it a bit for them, but, like, that's still a thing, so please be careful about discussing things. I would like to have regrades, et cetera, submitted by the Monday after break. If that, you know, we'll consider later regrades, but it really, you know, like that to happen. There's always questions about things like curves. So I don't do curves, because a curve is when you say, oh, we're gonna have a bell curve for our students, and, you know, that means that 20% get an A. That's not what I do. And I think we, you know, I think that's a bad thing to do. I will decide on the mapping to A, B, C, D, et cetera, at the end of the semester, taking the overall raw scores, and at that point, I will take into account how difficult were quizzes and exams. What I'm gonna be looking for is, does a typical student who has this score have competence in all the learning objectives as described in the department's sort of grade guidelines? And if so, I will try to make sure that score maps to an A. And as I mentioned in the policy, like, I'm guaranteeing like a 90 maps to at least an A minus. So if I decide that the threshold should have been a 94 for an A minus, and it's I'm going to put it at 90. If I decide it should be an 87, I'll put it at 87. But that's where I'm taking into account. I have in the past tried to do some, adjusting the grades for each midterm, but I think it's easier to do it all at once at the end, especially since they should also take into account how hard the quizzes are, and doing that every week would be a lot of extra work for not much benefit. So that's on that. So questions on logistics stuff. Yeah?
Is our actual copy of the midterm that we completed available through the submission site?
It is available through Gradescope, as it is scanned, yes. The physical copies I have, but I hope not to have to retrieve them. Because we scan them and also cut off the staples, so I hope not to have to retrieve those. But I've done it in the past when things have happened with discounts. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so we're talking about extending our practice to deal with conflict cases. And our key idea is what we'll call set associative caches. That I'm going to basically staple two direct map caches together to make a bigger cache. And this means that my sets, now the name set makes sense, can store two blocks, and each of those blocks has their own metadata about whether they're valid and what tag, identifies the address they came from. And we're going to have some terminology. I'm going to say that each of these rows is a set. I will call the sets set 0 for the first one, set 1 for the second one, based on the value of the index bits. Just like with the direct map cache, we know which set we're going to with the index bits. You have the same tag index offset idea as before, and kind of the same way to compute how many tag index and offset bits there are. Number of index bits based on the number of sets, number of rows. Number of offset bits based on the size of each block. I'm going to call each of the columns that we've created ways. And if I'm naming them, I'll typically name them way 0 or way 1. Or way 2, way 3, we can have more than two ways. I'm just not doing that because, showing an 8-way cache in the slide would probably not be helpful. And we can do kind of our same computations for how to split up addresses as we did before. So if we have 8-bit addresses and I have 2-byte blocks, that means I have 2 bits for my offset, or sorry, 1 bit for my offset. 2 to the 1 is 1. And if I have two sets here, that means I have one set index bits, which makes sense because our indices are 0 or 1. And everything left over in the address is a tag. So if I have 8-bit addresses, that means I have, in this case, 8 minus 1 minus 1, or a 6-bit tag. And we can sort of apply our idea to figure out how access patterns work on this new cache. So here, I'm accessing address 0, and I say its index bits is 0, and when I'm initially looking, nothing's valid, so it's definitely a miss, and I'm going to bring in that block. And remember, we decide what the extent of the block is based on going from, offset 0 of the block to the maximum offset. In this case, the maximum is 1. When I access 1 later on, that's going to be a hit. How am I going to look this up? Well, I'm going to take my index. I'm going to check my two possibilities now, but the check is the same as we've done for our direct map cache. I'm going to see, is it valid? And does the tag match? And then I'm going to find it, and I'm done. And if I didn't find it the first time, I would check the other way. In this case, I'd find out it's invalid. And also check there, and it's only a miss if I find it in neither of the possible ways. I'm still only checking one set, one row, but I'm checking all the ways in that row. And I guess we're going to kind of do this like check way zero, check way one, probably when we're doing it by hand. In the hardware, this will be done in parallel, because if you're building one of these caches in hardware, you'll like have two comparators for the tags for two ways to make that, you know, not that inefficient. So then we have an access to 6.3 here. So that has index 1. So I'm going to look here. I'm going to see, do I have this value already? So I'm going to check the first way, way 0. Find out that's invalid, so it can't be there. I check the other way. Find out that's invalid, so it can't be there. So this is a miss. And I'm going to put the value on a miss. I'm going to put that block in the cache. And like we've seen before, the cache block always starts at offset 0. Offset 0 means I have to flip this offset bit from 1 to 0, so it starts at 6.2, address 6.2. Then we access 6.1. That's going to go to way 0, and I'm going to check if it's in here. So I'm going to say, okay, so we're looking in way 0, set 0, and I'm going to check, is this valid? It is. Does the tag match? No, it doesn't. So it's not in way 0 of set 0. Then I'm going to check way 1 of set 0. I'm going to say, is it valid? No, so it's not there either. But I have to check both places. So that's going to be a miss. And on a miss here, we're going to put the value in the space that isn't used, because obviously that's better than replacing the value that is useful. So then we access address 6.2. So this is going to be index 1. And I'm going to check, our way 0, check the valid bit, check the tag, and it matches. So that's a hit. There. Then we access address 0. And this, in our old access pattern, was a conflict miss. Here, our sensitivity has helped us out. So we're going to check set 0. I'm going to see, is it valid? Does the tag match? So I find it. It's a hit. So questions about our process for using our two-way cache here. So then we get to a situation that's a little tricky. That's the access to 6.4. So here, I'm going to look in set 0. I'm going to see, this is valid. Does the tag match? No, it doesn't. So I'm going to check the other way. Is this valid? Yep. Does the tag match? No, it doesn't. So this is a miss. But the question is, where do we put address 6.4? So we're going to get to that question in a bit, but that's an extra thing we need to think about in our set associative cache that wasn't a concern in the direct map cache. In the direct map cache, we had one place it could go. Here, with the two-way cache, we have two places. And often these set associative caches will be like 8 or more ways, and we'll have even more choices. So we want to figure out, how do we choose reasonably where to put them out. So questions are access pattern here. Okay, so something I'd like to note, because I often see you careful, when we're doing our lookup in this cache, we have several possibility things that could happen. We could check all the blocks in the set, find out they're not valid. We could find out that, there are valid blocks, but none of the tags match. Or we could find there's one match. There will always be only one match if there's a match, because, we're going to check for the value before we replace something. So we're not going to store like two copies of a block. And as I mentioned, kind of the way this works in the hardware is that we need to, we want to do kind of this lookup actually in parallel. So usually in the hardware, there will be a memory which can take our index bits and get out the valid and tag bits all at once for everything in the set. And we'll have hardware that in parallel checks all the tags and all the valid bits for all the ways of that set. Which means that the sort of access cost of adding extra ways is not zero, because we need to like consolidate the results of multiple comparators. But because we've devoted space to having these extra comparators, it's similar to what a direct map cache will be, even though, yeah, the lookup's a bunch more complicated, bunch more steps. So let's go back to our question of what should this access replace. So I have a suggestion: how should we decide where to put this block? Yeah. Press the oldest one. Okay. So what do we mean by oldest?
Like last accessed.
Okay, so last accessed.
Least recently.
Yeah, so that's speaking ahead. So that is usually our policy. And why is this a reasonable policy? Is because of temporal locality. So if we want to take advantage of temporal locality, this is the policy we want to implement. And that takes advantage of temporal locality because we think that anything we've accessed recently, we're likely to access. We don't want to get rid of that. We want to get rid of older stuff. Now, there's a problem here, which is that, well, you know, I can figure out what the last access thing is because I say, okay, we're going to replace either 0-1 or 6-1. And I look here and I say, oh, we just accessed 0, which is part of 0-1. So therefore, you know, this policy tells me that this here is what I want to replace. So I can figure that out in this case from the picture. The problem is that our cache, you know, it doesn't have this table. Once we've handled an access, we're done with it. We're not like keeping the list of all the prior accesses. We, you know, in a typical program, we have a couple billion of them. Don't want to do that. So we need to figure out how to do the bookkeeping to implement a policy like that. So for that reason, some processors have implemented a policy that, even though it's worse at taking advantage of temporal locality, doesn't do, you know, this last accessed, you know, least recently accessed value idea, just to avoid the bookkeeping. And to give an example of such a policy, one idea is we just choose at random. And you might think, isn't that bad? It's not great, but it performs okay in practice. But usually processors are willing to devote some space to bookkeeping, so they'll try to do something like least recently used for determining that. So let's talk about what the bookkeeping for that looks like. And with two ways, this bookkeeping is a lot simpler. With two ways, the way we can do the bookkeeping for that is that we can add an extra bit for each set, indicating which part of the set is least recently used. So in this case, you know, I'm using my same way numbering. So this is, this is way 0, this is way 1. And after we insert address 60 and 61 into the cache, the other way of set 0 is the least recently used part, meaning that this is the next thing we'll replace when we need to insert into set 0. And you'll notice that in set one, our least recently used thing is set one, because that's empty, invalid, so we definitely haven't used it. And then, in this example, we have a bunch of accesses to 6.0 and 6.1, and that doesn't change anything. But a problem with this idea of doing this least recently used policy is that sometimes we're going to need to update that least recently used information on an access that's a hit. So for example, here, when I access address 0, that's going to be, oh, I have drawn this incorrectly, I see. Address 0, that's going to be in set 0 here. And it's going to be a hit. And in the old design, we could just be done. But we aren't done if we want to track the least recently used information. We need to update that least recently used bit to indicate that we just used the 0001 block, even though we didn't change what data was stored in our cache. But we need to update the metadata. And this means that this least recently used tracking is kind of expensive. But this is kind of a tolerable cost, but it means that we're turning things that used to be only reads into writes to the cache's storage. And as you can see in this example, we're next going to access something that also goes to set 0 that's going to be a miss. And where it goes, you know, it replaces the 6.0.6.1 because of that least recently used information. And on this right, we also update the LRU bit for the set. Okay. So questions? Yes. LRU tracking idea. So this is how it works if we have two ways in our cache. And like, it might seem like the intuitive extension of this to having three ways would be that we would, you know, if we have a third way, we just say, move this out of the way. We have our third way with a valid, a tag, and a value. And then we'd have our LRU. That would be like 0 through 2. That's kind of like the quote-unquote obvious extension, but it doesn't work. That's not enough to actually do this. And the problem is, when we have something like we have here, where we need to replace something, then we need to replace immediately something else in that same set. We need to figure out what the second least recently used thing is, you know, for that second replacement. So we actually need to track the order with two ways. Well, we only need one bit to track the order because it's either 0 then 1 or 1 then 0. With three ways, the orders are 0 then 1 then 2 or 0 then 2 then 1 or 0 or 1 then 0 then 2 or 1 then 2 then 0. We have a bunch more possibilities. And also, if we think of implementing a combinatorial circuit to do those updates, it's possible but kind of annoying. So this gets more complicated with more ways. The algorithm's relatively straightforward. We just track the order and update it. It's a little tedious to figure out what those updates would look like, especially if you're employing in hardware. And maybe more importantly, if we think of having like eight ways, that's actually a lot of extra metadata storage. and some pretty complicated logic to handle updating it. And so this means that if you look at real processors, most processors like LRU for their caches. They want to do something like LRU because they believe in locality. They believe that the best thing to replace is something we haven't accessed recently. They often do not implement true LRU because with even just four ways, it's probably not worth the bookkeeping. So usually you'll see them implement some sort of approximation where they won't keep track of all the information to actually do choose the least recently used thing, but they'll keep track of enough information to usually avoid choosing something that has been recently used, you know, even if they're not getting the order exactly right. Questions? Our replacement policy discussion. Okay. And I'll mention just briefly, but we won't test on it, that there's some other sort of common policies that processors have implemented where they've decided that even the approximations of least recently used are too complex to implement. You know, sometimes they haven't even tried, they just do first in, first out, which is like order things were added to the cache, or just random. So if you look at typical desktop and laptop and mobile phone processors today, they're usually doing an approximation of least recently used for their caches. Okay, so we've introduced our set associated caches. So questions on implementing least recently used? So the question is, the only reason we move away from LRU is because of the bookkeeping cost. If we believe there's good temporal locality, yes. However, there are programs which don't have good temporal locality, so sometimes you'll see processors implement something to handle an access pattern they know doesn't have temporal locality that isn't LRU. There's been reports that Intel has done this in some of their processors where they try to detect something that has bad temporal locality, most commonly like scanning a huge array, really bad temporal locality, and special case that in the replacement policy. But if you think there's temporal locality, you should do LRU. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we talked about caches and just some terminology. So direct map, we can kind of think of as a special case of our set associative cache. And we'll call our E way set associative cache is when we have E ways, E columns, kind of E direct map caches stapled together. And we can think of our direct map cache is just a one way set associative cache. It's just a special case of these set associative caches. And if there's this special case where there's one way, there's a special case where there's the maximum number of ways, and we have a special term for that too, we call that a fully associative cache. So a fully associative cache has one set in total, and that means that we have 2 to the 0 sets, which implies 0 index bits. So for a fully associative cache, we split up our addresses into a tag and an offset. And you might say, why are we talking about that? Because like that seems very expensive to build for like our memory caches, and it is, but there's other types of caches which will share this design where sometimes a fully associative might make sense for smaller caches. For a cache where we have like 256 blocks, probably we don't do fully associative because then we have to, you know, in our hardware probably have 256 comparators, and that's a lot for, unless it's really important and you really can't handle conflict misses. And also replacement policies in one of those caches sound like really annoying. But, you know, it's sort of it is the name for that opposite extreme, and we'll see some examples of that in not memory caches, but in some specialized caches for things like page table entries. So with caches, we can get our same kind of formulas we've seen before. And all of these are like formulas that were consequences of the things we saw for direct map caches. And most of these are the same as what we saw with direct map caches. That if we know we have big S sets, then little s equals log base 2 of the number of sets is the number of set index bits. Same as with direct map caches, with associative caches. If we know we have big B byte blocks, then log base 2 of that is the number of block offset bits. The number of tag bits is the size of our addresses after we get rid of the offset bits and the index bits. And like with direct map caches, our notion of cache size is always going to be the size without any metadata. And here's where we have a change. We have our times the number of ways. And you can think of this as a consequence of kind of stapling together a bunch of direct map caches, that we kind of increase our storage capacity by the number of caches we've stapled together. But the layout of addresses is the same as any one of those sort of component caches, those ways of our cache. Okay, some questions? And I guess my usual note is I don't recommend memorizing these formulas. I recommend knowing how to like go from our picture of the rows and columns of the cache to these formulas. Because I think that like serves people better than trying to remember, what is the B number? Which is error prone versus if you know kind of the higher level conceptual view. At least that's how I work. Maybe you don't. We're figuring this out. Okay, so our next topic is going to be about how cache accesses correspond to our code. So even though the cache is supposed to be kind of invisible to us, there are things we can do in how we write our programs that will affect how well the cache performs. And for this, we're going to talk mostly about data cache accesses. We mentioned that we typically have an instruction cache and a data cache. And the instruction accesses, we have some control over programs, but like they're kind of not really something we can easily manipulate. So I'm going to be less concerned about those than our data cache accesses, where the way we write our code to process data can dramatically affect how effective the data cache is for us. And to start thinking about that, let's look at this simple function here. I take a value as an argument and multiply it by a global variable called scale factor. Here's my assembly for this function. This is going to set EAX to the value to scale factor read from memory. Okay. Then it's going to set EAX to EDI, which is the first argument to this function under our calling convention, times EAX. And then we're going to return. My question here is, what data cache accesses does this function do? There are two of them. One of them is easy, one of them is a little hard. So can someone tell me about either one of those? Yeah. Okay, so here we're gonna talk scale factor. So this is a read of 4 bytes. So that's the easy one. There's another data cache access this code does. It's a lot more subtle. Yeah. Where we're returning to. So what are we accessing exactly?
The address you're returning to.
So the address, the return address, and where is that in memory and how big is it? Okay, stack, and it's an 8 bytes because that's the size of a pointer. Yeah. So those are two accesses that this code does. The return one is subtle. A lot of people, you know, miss that. But in x86, return works by popping a value from the stack, reading it. So this does two memory accesses with the data cache. It also accesses the instruction cache 3 times, once for each of the instructions. But as I said, we're going to mostly ignore that because as programmers, we have a lot less control over how the instruction cache behaves. So let's say we're using this function in a loop like this. And let's do kind of a little, you know, say we have some certain accesses for these 2 accesses. Let's say our return address in this loop. You know, because we're calling it from the same place in the loop, it's going to be the same every time. And our scale factor is located at this particular address. So we can figure out how these accesses are split up by a cache. So let's say, for our example, we have a 32 kilobyte. And when I'm talking about cache sizes, I always mean a power of 2, or some multiple of a power of 2 for a set associative cache. So here, this K really means 1,024 bytes, not 1,000. So this is going to be 2 to the 15, assuming, yes, 15 bytes. And 64 is 2 to the 6 bytes. So exercise here is, let's figure out the tag index and offset for these 2 addresses. And we're assuming, to keep things simple, that these are the physical addresses, even though we know that's probably not the... We really have to translate them to physical addresses to really know what's going on. But I'm just keeping things simple by ignoring the virtual memory translation that would happen. Figure out the tag index and offset. Come and tell me a first step for doing that process. What would be a good first thing to do to figure out how to get the tag index and offset for these values? Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the block size. How does that get us the offset?
Since the number would be 6 bits for the offset.
Okay. So you're saying because it's 2 to the 6, we have 6-bit offset. And so I can kind of work out here that we have something, and then we have a 3... and then a B, and then an 8, and these bits are the offsets. Next, I'll just do the top address, the return address, start out. So for the index bits, we want to figure out the number of sets in the cache. And one way I can do that is I can say, well, if we have 2 to the 15 bytes total divided by 64 bytes a block, that means we have, and 64 is 2 to the 6, we have 2 to the 9 blocks. And we have one set per block, because this is a direct map cache, which means we have 2 to the 9 sets. We have 2 to the 9 sets. We have 9 index bits. So the next 9 bits are index. So this is our index here, and we need to get the next digit here, which is a 4. And we want 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's our index. And everything left over is the tag, which we could write out. I'm going to save myself time and space by not doing that. But, you know, probably I take out a calculator or something like that. So questions on how we figured out sort of the number of offset and index bits and what part of the address they are? Okay, so if we do this work for both the values, I have the answer I have hopefully computed correctly in advance. And by magical coincidence, or rather just me setting up this problem very deliberately, they both have the same index bits. Both ends up being 10E. And, well, that is a way I set up this problem, but this is why we want to use the set associative cache. Is because these coincidences, you know, in a big program, they're going to happen every once in a while. And if we look at think about what that would mean with our direct map cache, that would mean that this would be a miss, and this would be a miss, evicting, and every time, because even though we have this loop, each time we access scale factor, it would replace the return address. And each time we access the return address, it would replace scale factor in the cache. With 2 ways, we could avoid this, because even if they map still have the same index, which they would, because we make this a 2-way cache, what's that going to change? Well, with a 2-way cache, we're going to have instead of having this one, we're going to have 2 to the 9 blocks. I should write that clearly. Blocks. And 2 blocks per set, which means we'll have 2 to the 8 sets if it were a 2-way cache. So we'd have one less set index bit. So the index bits would still be the same. But since we had 2 slots in each set, we wouldn't have that sort of catastrophic miss situation. So questions, some people look confused, so I assume there's something I am missing explaining. Not seeing questions. Okay. Yes, another possible intuition for the why do we have one less set index bit if we go up to 2 ways is that we're going from a direct map cache that looks like this to something with the same number of blocks, but we've kind of cut it in half and moved the other half on the other side. And our number of sets, which determines the number of set index bits, has been cut. The number of sets, the number of rows. Okay, so let's talk about accesses to arrays. And here I have a little, you know, exercise where we have an array with 4 elements, and I have a direct map cache with 8-byte blocks. So 8 bytes equals 2 array elements. And the question is, how many cache misses do we have for this code? And we'll assume for all these examples I'm going to do, that all the local variables are stored in register, so they don't use the data cache, and the array does use the data cache. And we'll also assume the cache starts initially empty, just to make things simpler, even though, yeah, technically, when we're running this for real, maybe part of the array is already in the cache. We'll assume that didn't happen. And here, I have a one-set direct map cache. So this is my cache. I have space for 8 bytes. What the question is, how many data cache misses do we have? So I'll go through. So who? And we're accessing array of 0, then array of 1, array of 2, then array of 3. So who thinks we'll have exactly 2 misses? Who thinks we'll have exactly 3 misses? Who thinks we'll have 4 or more misses? So who has no clue? So I think, like, the guess I would, you know, make with this information is, oh, there's probably 2 misses, because, well, you know, we have to load 16 bytes of things. Hopefully we're accessing them in order, so we're gonna load 2 elements, then we're gonna load the next 2 elements. There's a problem. It's that we didn't provide you information about how the array maps to cache blocks. And the 2 answer, you know, is what we get if we say the array maps to cache blocks such that array 0 and 1 are in one cache block and array 2 and 3 are in one cache block. And in that case, I can kind of work out very manually what happens with the cache, that we read array 0, it's a miss. We update array 0 and we update the cache to contain the block with array 0 and array 1. Remember, the blocks are kind of fixed based on the offset bits. Then we read array 1, it's a hit. We read array 2, it's a miss. That replaces the contents of our cache because we only can store one block at a time in this cache, this very, very simple cache. Then we read array 3 and it's a hit. So then you get 2. You can also get 3. Because it didn't tell you where the array was. And, you know, here I placed the array such that we read array 0, and we bring array 0 into the cache, and it happens that array 0 has offset bits that are 4 and not 0. So there's something before it in its cache block that gets brought into the cache. That's totally useless for this code, but the cache doesn't know that. It's just going to bring it in mechanically. Then we bring in array 1, and that brings in array 1 and 2 in this example. And so array 2 is a hit, and array 3, well, we bring in array 3 and the thing after it, but even though we don't care about that in this code, you know, the cache is mechanical, it's still going to read that in from memory and store it in case we want it later. And you'll notice that, like, I've marked off the individual bytes in the cache block, and I only did 2 of the possibilities. You know, either array 0 is at the beginning of a block, or it's halfway in the block. You know, maybe we could also do this. So in this case, to read array 0, we need to read 2 different cache blocks. Seems pretty annoying. And to read array 2, we need to read 2 different cache blocks. So here we have, depending on how we count, either 2 or 3 misses. Interesting. And you might say, this situation seems bad. Like, this situation seemed inconvenient, but with a bigger array, it's not going to be a huge deal. This is bad. We don't want to do this. And so for this reason, we actually do avoid this situation. This situation is harder to avoid, I'll talk later, but this situation we do avoid. And the way we avoid it is that compilers and malloc and implementations try to give you what are called aligned values, usually meaning that the values are at a multiple of the size of the value. So in the case of our array, we'd like our array elements to be at an address that's a multiple of 4 of the size of each element. meaning that this situation can't happen. And that prevents us from having these accesses that cross cache block boundaries, which, yes, we can do, but they're a lot more expensive, and if you do them all the time, your code will run slower. Now, avoiding this situation, we do less often. And that's because, well, the biggest cost is from having one read access to cache blocks. Also, in our real caches, we often have 64-byte cache blocks. So if we wanted to make every array kind of start at the beginning of a cache block, well, then we'd be adding 32-ish bytes of padding for every array. If we assume, like, before the array is some random address. And you'd probably be unhappy if all your arrays in your code became 32 bytes bigger, especially in, like, a web browser that already uses a lot of memory. Yeah, so this is not usually something we do automatically, though you could set it up manually, with most compilers you wanted. You may have noticed if you, in the page table homework, you use POSIX memalign, which gives you the option of specifying that alignment number. This is one of the uses of that function's alignment parameter. So questions about this alignment idea? Okay, so let's do another exercise, and let's assume that we're in the good case that array zero is at the very beginning of a cache block. And here I've changed our access pattern, and the intuition you should have here is we should think about locality. That's how we're gonna kind of get a quick guess as to what's going on. And something I've done here is I've made the locality worse, the spatial locality. So in our previous example, we went zero, then one, then two, then three. So we're accessing things that are next to each other. Here, we're not like jumping really far away, but the spatial locality is worse. So we don't expect this to behave better in the cache. The question is, like, how much worse is it, or is it, the same? So the same one set cache, question is, how many cache misses are there? Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the count should be. Who would like some more time? A couple of people. Okay. Okay, so let's start with who thinks we'll have, we'll go exactly two misses. Exactly three misses. Exactly four misses. Okay, some other number of misses. No clue. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus on four, which is what I get. And a way I can figure this out is I first need to figure out how does the array kind of get stored in the cache. And we are told that array zero is the beginning of a cache block. And since our cache blocks are 8 bytes, that means array zero and array one is one cache block. And right after that must be the next cache block of memory, which is array two and three. And since our cache can only hold one block at a time, I'm just tracking the whole contents of the cache. So we read array zero, that's a miss, and we load this cache block. We read array two, that's a miss, we load this cache block, because we always assume we have temporal locality, even though in this case it would really have been better if we just didn't load up the cache for array two. Cache is not smart enough to know that. Doesn't, can't predict the future. So we're going to load up array two and three. Yes?
For reading array two, why did we load array two and array three instead of array one and array three?
Question, why did we load array two and array three instead of array one and array three? So when we've divided our memory into cache blocks, the sort of this address here has offset bits equal to zero. And that means this address is offset bits are equal to seven. And similarly, this is now zero up to seven. And our cache block always goes from offset zero to the maximum offset. Because of our cache's design, we need to make sure that, you know, that it always sort of lines up that way, because that's how our lookup works. If we wanted to do this idea, you know, that isn't crazy of storing cache blocks that kind of are misaligned, you know, that aren't at a multiple of the block size, then we need to add an extra metadata tracking to remember where they came from and to deal with extracting the right bytes when someone reads it. And caches generally haven't found that worthwhile. Yeah. When reading array one, do we load array zero and array one because array one is offset seven? I would say array one is from offset four to seven, but yes. Exactly. So we load, yeah, starting at offset zero. Other questions? Okay, so when we read array one, we load zero and one. Then we read array three and load two and three. So these are all misses. And everything but the first miss, we probably would have preferred to skip loading the cache, but our caches are designed with this locality assumption in mind. And what happened here is I wrote my program in a way where I had bad locality, and the cache was assuming I didn't have bad locality, so it did the wrong thing for me. So let's think about this with a bigger cache. So let's say I have a two-set cache. So now my cache has, we have a valid and a tag and a value, and I have index 0 and 1. I have two different places in my cache. And my question is now, how many, we're back to good locality, how many misses do we have here? And again, each cache block is 8 bytes, so it can store two array elements.
I
Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have three or fewer misses? How about exactly four? Okay, more than four? No clue? Okay, so most people got exactly four. And I'll show kind of one way of systematically doing it. So I guess I will say the simple way to get exactly four is to say, okay, so each cache block is two array elements. We're accessing eight array elements. So there can be a minimum of four misses because we're accessing four different cache blocks. And then I look at, well, do we access cache blocks multiple times? Well, yes, 0 and 1 are together, 2 and 3, 4 and 5, 6 and 7. But we finish accessing one cache block before moving on to the next. And so that's a way I can get 4. I can say there's 4 total cache blocks. We access one cache block before moving on to the next. Therefore, exactly 4. Let me show you kind of a more systematic way that will work if we have a less regular access pattern. So one thing I want to figure out is how does my array get divided up into cache blocks? And it's if we want to track what exactly happens in the cache, we want to figure out which goes to index 0 and index 1. And I will assume, to keep things simple, that the array starts at index 0. I'll talk about why that assumption doesn't change my answer as far as number of misses or things like that. But I promise you now it doesn't. We'll just assume it's 0, then 1. And because of how index bits work, when we add 1 to index 1, and it's only 1 bit, we get a 0. That's how that wraps around. And one way I can do this is I can track the entire contents of the cache after each access. So I say we access array 0. That's going to read in the block containing array 0 and 1. That's index 0, so it goes here. We read array 1, it's a hit. I access array 2, I access the blocks containing array 2 and 3, and this is index 1, so it goes here. I access array 4, that gives me 4 and 5. It goes to index 0 because that's how this got mapped. And then similarly with 6. So just tracking every single access that goes on. Now, there's a bunch of busy work here in that I was tracking what was going on with set 1 when I was accessing set 0, and the access to set 0 is either going to be a hit and change nothing, or it's going to be a miss and only change set 0. So I could, in fact, just look at the set 0 accesses independently and ignore everything about set 1 and compute how many misses are there here. I can say, okay, just looking at things that use set 0, we have 0, 1, then 4, 5. 0 and 1, miss, then hit. 4 replaces 0 and 1, 5. And I can ignore all the other accesses because I know they don't affect set 0. They don't look at set 0. This is everything that happens to set 0. And I can repeat this process for set 1. So I can kind of consider each set independently. And if we had a bigger cache with like 128 sets, for many access patterns we find, oh, there's a pattern here. What happens with set 0 is going to be the same as set 0, 1, 2, up to 100. And we can kind of compute exactly what happens without needing to do the full tedium of having, 128 wide spreadsheet actually figuring it out. But figuring out, the cache contents of every step, we can just realize, oh, there's a pattern where each set behaves the same, and we can look at each set individually so we don't have a huge number of things to consider. So, questions? This idea. Okay, so let's let's do this exercise and one. Why don't we switch to, we'll do skip up to this exercise. For time, So So same cache, but now our access pattern is a bit less regular. I would write things down for this one, first. We'd like some more time. New people, okay. Okay, so who thinks we have, I'll start with, exactly four misses, exactly five misses, exactly six, seven, eight, okay, so we have some split, Most people say five. So I think there are two ways of solving this. So I'll first start with, I'll just keep track of the total contents of the cache. So we have an access to array 0. And I'm going to assume that 0 and 1 map to set 0, 2 and 3 map to set 1, the block containing 4 and 5 map to set 0, and the block containing 6 and 7 map to set 1. You might say, what if it's the other way around? I promised I'd show like why this doesn't matter. And the reason why it's not going to affect our answer is that we can see in this example, let's say I have all this numbering wrong, and I relabel the blocks with different set indices. In that case, I just relabel this as set 1 after, and relabel this as set 0 after, and my analysis is completely correct. So it's just a labeling issue, so we can, for our analysis, pretend it starts at index 0, even though we know in practice that might not be true, isn't going to affect our counting, as long as our relative, set numbers are equivalent. Okay, so going to our solution here. So then I will work through and figure out what happens. So we access 0, that's a miss, and that means set 0 is going to contain array elements 0 and 1 as a block. We access 3, that's a miss, and 3 is in set 1, so that means array elements 2 and 3. Why starting with 2? Well, because if the first block starts at 0, the next one starts at 2. We never store things that start at an offset that's not 0 in our offset bits. So it stores 2, 3. Then we access 6. That's going to be another miss. 6 goes to set 1. So that's going to replace the 2 and 3. The 0 and 1 elements remain unchanged. We access 1. That's a hit. Then we access, and we still have the same contents. Then we access 4, and that's going to be a miss. We see that 4 and 5 are in set 0, so that's going to replace 0 and 1. The 6 and 7 remain unchanged. We access 7, that's a hit. Everything remains unchanged. We access 2, that's a miss. We're going to replace 6 and 7 with 2 and 3. The 4 and 5 remain unchanged. Then we access 5, and that's a miss. And I get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If I counted correctly. Oh, sorry. We access 5, and that's a hit. Yes, so I get 5 misses. That's a hit because 4 and 5 does include 5. I'd like to note that we could have also kind of maybe simplified our work by just doing this in set by set. So for example, access 0, 1, and 4, then 5, those are all the accesses to set 0. So I can just separately, and I did this on the side here, analyze only what happens to set 0. I count 2 misses. I do the same analysis for set 1, and I will count 3 misses, and I get the 5 back. So questions on... Yeah?
Could you explain the first time when we encounter a miss and we have to like change the value?
First time when I encounter a miss, you mean like here?
No, like when we have to like replace the value.
So like here. So here, I'm accessing 6 and 7. It has to go to set 1. That's the only place I'm allowed to store 6 or 7. So I'm going to replace the block that's there. This is a direct map cache. There's only one block to replace. I have no choice. So I'm going to bring in 6 and 7, array of 6 and 7, and have it replace array of 2 and 3. And I just don't have any other options to do anything else because we're using our index bits to say where in the cache to go. So that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll maybe do a little extra of this and then talk about how we write values with a cache. So far we've only been reading that.